Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. This is Internet Talk Radio, recorded from the west coast of Sweden. I am the editor of RedIceCreations.com, a website dedicated to news, research, and we also do this radio show, of course. We have a new program available for you every Thursday and Sunday. Interviews with interesting guests, researchers, authors on new and old subjects, take it or leave it, it's all free stuff for you there to enjoy and consider. We also have a subscriber section with even more radio shows available for you guys who want to have a little bit more each week, and this is what makes it possible for us to keep going and keep up the work that we do here. Today we have a very interesting program lined up for you. We have author, researcher Joseph P. Farrell with us on the line. And Joseph is behind Reich of the Black Sun, the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. He's also behind a three-part book series called The Giza Death Star, The Giza Death Star Deployed and The Giza Death Star Destroyed. And I hope to spend some time on those last three mentioned books in the next segment. A lot of interesting stuff lined up today. Joseph's website, by the way, that you need to check out is GizaDeathStar.com, where you can follow along and in his blog and much more. And I do want to spend some time in this first segment to talk a little bit about Joseph, of course, his background, research, and dive into his books, Reich of the Black Sun and SS Brotherhood of the Bell. So with that, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Joseph P. Farrell. Thank you for spending some time with us today, Joseph.
Well, thank you for having me on, Henrik. It's a pleasure and an honor for me.
Excellent. It's great to have you here. You know, I first heard you on Dreamland last fall, I think it was.
Whitley Strieber, that's right.
That's right, yes. I was fascinated by your research and your material, and I myself have been very into the whole Nazi connection to both the occult, but also the kind of technological developments, everything from rockets to the alleged, at least, flying saucers, etc. So this is going to be fascinating to talk more about this today. And what I would like to do to begin today, to kick things off, so for our listeners who might not have heard about you before, maybe we can get, you know, a little bit on your background and, you know, when you first maybe began, you know, to take an interest in World War II and, of course, the Nazi history itself, and, you know, how you come onto this path, so to speak.
Well, my father was an engineer, so I always had kind of an interest in engineering and physics. Physics has always been a hobby of mine since I was a boy. It's not actually what I've been formally academically trained in. That training was largely in areas of ancient church history and theology, which of course exposed me to a lot of ancient texts. And I began to notice very quickly when I studied those things that there was a kind of a hidden physics implication to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And that it kind of coalesced in recent years for me when I read a book by Christopher Dunn called The Giza Power Plant, in which he takes an engineer's approach to kind of decipher the mystery of what the Great Pyramid was, and he came to the conclusion that it was a gigantic machine. And that kind of kicked off things for me. I began to research the pyramid and ancient texts and things of that sort. And as far as World War II goes, I have always been, since boyhood, fascinated with the military history of World War II. I used to play strategy games. I still do, as a matter of fact, but kind of complex things. And I began to notice that the tail end of World War II really, from a military standpoint, an operational standpoint, didn't really make much sense. You know, we had the U.S. Third Army under General Patton racing just kind of hell-bent for leather, if I can use that language, into southern Germany and on into central Czechoslovakia, into Prague and the environs around Prague. And that didn't make any sense to me from a conventional point of view. And then, of course, the deployments on the German side were equally as mystifying. Hitler had deployed most of his remaining battle-worthy formations in front of the Silesian German city of Breslau, which is now modern-day Wrocław in Poland. So, you know, there was just a lot of things that kind of set me off on figuring out what was going on at the end of World War II. It ultimately led me into these areas that I explore in the two books.
Fascinating. So tell us a little bit about Reich of the Black Sun. I mean, let's start with the Black Sun itself. I mean, any connection to the swastika there, the Nazi banner?
Sure, of course there is. I have on the cover of the book, I reprint one of the secret society logos, as it were, that was used by the Thule Gesellschaft inside of Germany.
Yeah.
And that symbol on the cover of the book is actually a kind of a stylized representation of an ancient teaching called the Black Sun, which, depending on who you read, it's a source of illumination, but also in some versions of the story, it's kind of a hidden power source or something that lies at the center of our galaxy. So there was a great deal of esoteric influence behind the choice of the swastika and some of the other symbols used by the Nazis, as I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah,
would be one of them.
Yeah. Any connection in your research to Saturn and the Saturnalian Brotherhood and so forth?
Well, none that I have come across thus far. That's not to say that there isn't, because as well as I do in this field of research, the connections can multiply like rabbits.
Oh yeah, indeed.
Oftentimes an individual researcher won't uncover things that others have, so I wouldn't rule it out. I'm just not familiar with it.
So in your research, I guess you follow a line in the theme, that there was a tremendous amount of occult activity within the SS and also within the real society, and as you mentioned, the Thule Gesellschaft, right?
Oh yes, absolutely. One of the things I point out in both Reich of the Black Sun and in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell is that the SS at its highest command levels of Obergruppenführer and Gruppenführer, in other words, SS generals, these men were more or less aware of Himmler's own obsession with the occult and were expected, in a certain sense, to be initiated into it. Now, in the case of the topics I explore in the two books, the SS general that I'm concerned with the most is a fellow by the name of Hans Kammler, who would have had the equivalent SS rank of a colonel general in the German Wehrmacht.
Mm-hmm.
So Kammler is the man that, by the war's end, is heading up all, and I mean all, of Nazi Germany's secret weapons projects. And given that the SS does have this kind of hidden occult agenda at work, it would not surprise me that there is some connection between some of these projects that the Nazis are pursuing and various occult doctrines like the Black Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we can kind of even see the swastika itself as kind of a very schematic or stylized way of representing a vortex. Which, of course, is a key concept for some of the physics, I believe, that they were investigating.
Ah, interesting. In regards to the Black Sun, esoteric information, of course, do you think that there is a connection with Hindu mythology, something like that?
I would suspect that there is, and I would suspect also that there is a very strong connection with ancient Sumerian and Babylonian mythology, because, again, Germany was, of course, between the wars, home of some of the world's premier Sumerologists and Assyriologists. So, yes, it would not surprise me at all if there are all of these connections kind of playing in the background. The difficulty has always been to find exact or specific references in the literature that these things are at work. What we have to do is kind of conjecture on the basis of known esoteric doctrines and then kind of connect the dots to some of the physics projects that they're involved in.
So there isn't any clear, as you say, documented, information in regards to what the Nazis themselves might have, why they chose to go with the Black Sun, I guess.
Right. There isn't a clear known documentary trail, but I should add an important point. The SS Occult Investigative Bureau, it was called the Annenerbedienst, was set up by Reichsführer we would consider the occult or the paranormal or the esoteric.
Sure.
So there does exist a large, large body of literature and documents from the Anan Erebidin, but they still remain more or less locked up in American archives and the Berlin Document Center in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. And for the most part, they really have not been examined in any real scholarly detail, and this is the problem.
And why do you think that they kind of went into this direction? I mean, is it about exploring all possible scenarios or means of, you know, acquiring different type of technology or weaponry? What's your take on it?
Well, I think ultimately it is for the acquisition of weaponry and of course extension of Nazi power. I think that the impetus also comes to a certain extent from Nazi ideology, and that in turn, of course, would trace back to some of these secret society connections that more or less helped the midwife, the Nazi party, into existence. Again, the Thule Gesellschaft or the Vril Gesellschaft and some of these other secret societies in the interwar period in Germany. So there is this impetus in occult literature and in occult doctrine, of course, to acquire power by means otherwise not considered normal. And in terms of the physics, then, I think that this means, of course, that the Nazis would have prohibited pursuit of anything relativistic as being kind of tainted with connections to their arch enemies, the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they were thrown back by the nature of the case on the other types of physics that were being developed in the interwar period inside of Germany, and that would have been quantum mechanics, first of all, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the other area that's not very well known, and that would be vortex mechanics that would have been developed by people like Professor Dr. Gerlach and Dr. Hilgenberg and some of their associates.
Interesting. And I just wanted to ask you there, do you think that there is any difference today in regards to how, you know, military actually, in what areas that they go with their research, considering, you know, that we have clear connections between the Nazis and the U.S. so forth, you know, obviously
right,
with the paperclip project and so on?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's one I really get into in both books, particularly the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, rather extensively. And I don't know, you know, your European listeners may be unfamiliar with the story, but the modern American CIA is really an outgrowth of the wartime American Secret Service called the OSS.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, in 1944, the station chief, American station chief of the OSS in Zurich, Switzerland, was a fellow by the name of Alan Dulles. He's very well known in this country. I don't know how well known he would be in Europe.
He's got an Air Force.
Pardon me?
Yeah, he's got an Air Force base named after him, right?
Yes, he has an Air Force base, and of course, Dulles International Field outside of Washington, D.C. is named after him.
Ah, yeah.
He subsequently became a director of the CIA in the 60s, and of course was fired by President Kennedy after the botched Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba. But Dulles negotiated with a German general by the name of Reinhard Gehlen, who commanded Germany's Fremde Heere Ost, which was of course their military intelligence on the Eastern Front. And what they negotiated was basically that Gehlen turned over to the United States the entire military intelligence operation of the German Wehrmacht in Eastern Europe intact. Now, this is very important from the standpoint of American law, because in 1947, when President Truman signed the charter that started the CIA and the NSA, he specifically signed a law that stated that no military connections to these agencies could be made, and the law, moreover, came as kind of a part of a package of policies in in use at that time that prohibited ardent Nazis from participating in these sensitive areas of the American government. So we have here really a violation almost at the inception of the CIA, in fact before the inception of the CIA, where the entire operational Soviet desk is being run by a bunch of Nazis. So, yeah, I'd say that that constitutes a pretty serious penetration of American intelligence.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, so do you think that these guys, you know, continued their agenda, so to speak, or were they actually converted? I mean,
well, yeah, that you know, that's the $64,000 question, because, you know, there are little indicators, and I cite these in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, that even the German scientists acted oftentimes like they were independent of the American authorities supposedly overseeing them. And this is a complaint that you hear of Dr. von Braun and Dr. Rudolph and General Dornberger almost immediately after the war ends, and they kind of keep their own command structure in place between them. They even have private briefings after they meet with their American interrogators, making sure that they're saying exactly what needs to be said and no more. So, in other words, yeah, the answer to your question is yes. The Nazis continued a kind of a quasi-independent existence, I believe, inside of the military and industrial complex in this country. I think that there are little indicators that they continued kind of an independent or quasi-independent existence inside of our space program. And I think that there is a certain body of evidence that would even suggest that in terms of those Nazis that did not end up either in the Soviet Union's hands or in the United States' hands, continued their own independent lines of research completely free of any other powers' oversight. So it's a very, very important question that you asked.
You know, I have to ask this one because it's too interesting to stay away from, considering that, you know, the U.S. was on the moon in 69 and never has been back since. This, you know, obviously, you know, begs the question, did these guys, you know, help along and develop the moon project and so forth? But after, when they were gone, were the knowledge lost, meaning that, you know, the Americans in its current, you know, conception in that sense don't have the technology to actually go back to the moon?
Right. Well, this, you know, this is something that has made the rounds of the talk shows in this country as well. And it's a question that is not only a good one, it's almost so obvious that one hesitates even to ask it.
Sure,
I think you're right.
I
think that, you know, the American space program is just in a complete shambles. You know, we're using a launch vehicle that's 30 years old. The technology is basically falling apart, and we haven't developed anything really new. Meanwhile, Russia, you know, with its Energia boosters, is sitting on top of some pretty good space technology. And they have continued to develop it. I think that the American state of affairs right now could be written off not only to the loss of some of these German scientists, but also to some just incredibly bad management decisions that were made in the last 30 years within NASA that when you get right down to it, kind of boggle the mind.
It does, yeah, absolutely.
That's probably another show.
It is, yeah, absolutely. You know, let's back things up a little bit more and return to, you know, pre the Nazis going over to the U.S. and talk a little bit about the, you know, the Wunderwaffe, as it were. There's a lot of, you know, speculation on what this actually was, and I know that you go into your book, you know, speculating about, you know, Patton and so forth, what he thought, what the weapon actually was, and that there was danger actually still, you know, when the war was coming to a close, that, you know, the Germans in the last minute basically could, you know, turn the war again. Talk a little bit about that, if you will.
Right. Well, in Reich of the Black Sun, I outline what I believe is a pretty solid circumstantial and prima facie case that Nazi Germany may have actually acquired atomic bombs prior to the end of the war. They certainly tested successfully many times, not only during the war, but even prior to it, very early prototypical versions of fuel air bombs. So in other words, they had an arsenal of mass destruction certainly available to them. And it's my belief that they probably employed some version of their fuel air bomb technology on the Eastern Front, which is why we've never heard about it, because, again, Stalin would have been loath to admit publicly that, you know, he was facing a technologically superior enemy. And it also would explain just the enormous kill ratios, if one wants to get particularly gruesome and use the military term for it. It would explain the German army's just phenomenally high kill ratios on the Eastern Front. I mean, my goodness, we're talking about casualties inflicted on Soviet Russia that are in excess of 25 million people. And to my way of thinking, there's no way really operationally that that would be possible simply by mere conventional warfare. I think that there was something else involved. And I think that, that part of the explanation lies in the use by the Nazis on the Eastern Front of some of these technologies that they had available. But more importantly, you ask about the Wunderwaffe. I take the line that the Polish researcher Igor Witkowski takes, that that term cannot be applied to their vengeance weapons rockets for the simple reason that the Nazis applied other terms to those weapons. They were, after all, the Vergeltungswaffen, they were the vengeance weapons. The Wunderwaffe was a term that was used and found in documents in Nazi propaganda right up to the end of the war, and I believe there's really only one project in the Nazi Black Project's arsenal that fills that bill, and that's this device that's called the Bell. This was a device that the Nazis had classified as Kriegsentscheidend, which is a term meaning war decisive. And that term itself is unique to that project. It's a classification that's higher than any other project, and I mean any, including their A-bomb project, inside of the Third Reich. So we are dealing with there, I think, with what the Nazis were calling the Wunderwaffe.
So, yeah, there we are, you know, into the information about the Bell, obviously, of course. But before we go there, you know, let's talk a little bit more about Igor. Is there something more you know about him? He's kind of essential, I guess, to your research. And his book wasn't available in English until, what was it, 5 years ago, 3 years ago?
I think that's right. I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, right?
And who do you know anything more about this guy, Igor Witkowski, and where he
is? Well, Igor and I are in pretty regular contact with each other because we still exchange and swap information as it comes available to us. Igor is a first-class military journalist and researcher. His book, The Truth About the Wunderwaffe, is just, I think, probably the best book on German secret weapons. It's thoroughly researched. The conclusions he comes to in it on every aspect of Nazi secret weapons steers very close to the evidence. And it's that book, really, that makes the story of the Bell available to the English world. The other book that's essential for anyone researching the Bell, of course, would be Nick Cook's book, The Hunt for Zero Point. But his book is based largely on Witkowski's research. So Witkowski is really kind of the origin of the story because he's the one that unearthed the original documentation and the sites inside of Silesia, which of course are now in Poland, that the Bell was tested at. So he's the absolute crucial person to consider when anyone does research on the Bell.
You know, I've heard the rumors that there was, you know, certain underground areas, caves and whatnot, within, you know, when the Nazis had the entire empire, you know, when you, as you say, Poland was included, and a lot of other places in Europe too, that they actually, you know, booby-trapped a lot of these places, and that they actually were inaccessible from after the war. Is this something, you know, that you have been able to confirm in your work?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, that's true. Igor has uncovered just a massive underground complex in a little German village called Ludwigsdorf. The modern Polish name for the little village, I believe, is Ludwikowice.
Okay.
The mine facility was called the Wenceslas Mine. And these tunnels are several kilometers long. They're very deep, and many of them are flooded out, and most likely intentionally so. And there are other tunnels that he's found in other installations in the region that have simply been blasted shut by the SS as the war was closing, and that probably still are booby traps. So these stories are absolutely true. The Nazis, just to kind of embellish that story a little bit further, the Nazis, as the war was ending, the bell was considered so important to them that they murdered 60 of the scientists that were involved with the project, buried them in a mass grave. And the only reason that we know about the bell is that the SS general that was tasked with the murders, a fellow by the name of Jakob Sporenberg, was tried after the war by a Polish war crimes court for murdering his own people on what subsequently became Polish soil. So, you know, it's his trial affidavit, in other words, that gives us the story of the bell.
Interesting. If we are to kind of dive into, I guess, the more nuts and bolts to, you know, what the bell actually is and so forth, I don't know, you know, where we actually should lead into this, or where your point into all of this is. I mean, we could, I guess, speculate on the fact that they, you know, came up to this technological knowledge because of a downed or crashed, you know, unidentified flying object, as it were, something like that. Or do you think that these guys basically started from scratch and developed a technology? What's your take on it?
Well, I think I'm familiar with the allegations that there was some sort of crash and retrieval operation that occurred inside of Nazi Germany prior to the war. I've never been able to document that to my satisfaction. That being said, however, I do point out in Reich of the Black Sun that Benito Mussolini had set up a very secret research bureau in fascist Italy to investigate UFO phenomena, and I reproduce some of those documents in that book. So there is certainly something going on, at least as far as Italy is concerned, with UFOs. And at some point after the Axis Pact is signed, I think that Mussolini most likely made that information available to the Nazis. So there is some sort of tenuous UFO connection that's there, but I simply have never been able to verify a crash. Now, as far as the bell is concerned, then, I think this means that the physicists that were working on the bell, I think, had ample theoretical basis on what had occurred in physics up to that time from which to pursue some of these ideas. The physicist that actually headed up the bell was, in fact, a Nobel laureate by the name of Professor Dr. Walter Gerlach, who's, you know, one of the most famous physicists in the world at the time. He's right up there in the league with Albert Einstein. So Gerlach's specialty was gravitation and magnetic spin and things like this, and he is also the man that mentored another famous German physicist by the name of Hilgenberg, who developed his own very unique vortex mechanics as kind of an alternative to relativity theory. So there is this massive theoretical impetus that's taking place in Nazi Germany, and even in the Weimar Republic, if one really goes back far enough, to develop some of these ideas. And I think the bell really kind of represents the culmination of some of that thinking.
Interesting. And speaking of this alternative physics, this is something then that they actually were potentially utilizing in the technology. Is there a connection here with the, you know, the entire alchemy and mercury thing? Is this it?
Oh yes, absolutely. Mm. One of the things that Witkowski even points out in his book, The Truth About the Wunderwaffe, is that the Bell apparently relied on some form of mercury isotope and most likely other elements in compound with it. And this, I think, is an interesting thing because Gerlach writes an article in 1928, I believe it is, from mm-hmm. Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, in which he speculates on the ability of mercury under stress to transmute into other elements, and he calls it a form of alchemy.
Yeah.
So in other words, he is thinking very specifically along the lines that you're suggesting. And I think, given the fact that Germany is also home at the time to some of the world's premier Assyriologists and Sumerologists, that he probably is aware of some of these alchemical texts and ideas. So
yeah.
I don't discount that possibility at all. I think that that is definitely in play.
Interesting. And potentially then, do you think that the... that the Bell itself actually is a flying machine or an opening of portals? What's your, you know, do you speculate on this at all?
Oh, yes, I do. I do believe, and this is kind of where I part company somewhat with Nick Cook and Igor Witkowski. Mm-hmm. I do believe that the Bell is primarily a weapon. And
okay.
In fact, I'm kind of... beginning to write a sequel to mm-hmm. the SS Brotherhood of the Bell
mm-hmm.
In the last week or so.
Oh, fascinating.
Trying to outline some more things that I've discovered about it. I do think it was a weapon. However, I think that in the process of developing and testing the physics for this device, that they also knew that it would have certain anti-gravitational effects, and that those in turn, by the nature of the case, implied manipulations of space and time.
Hmm.
I don't go so far as to say it's a time machine or a portal or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
but those effects nevertheless would have been present in the device simply on the basis of the physics involved.
Hmm. Interesting. You know, I read that there is a connection, or someone make the connection, and you have to clarify exactly who makes this assertion and so forth, but that, there was a potential opening of some kind of, I guess we could refer it to a stargate, and actually, you know, traveling to a planetary system in the Andromeda galaxy, right?
Well, I don't mention those in my books, but that is a story, a legend that's been around, really, mm. since the end of the war, that there was some sort of project, apparently named Project Andromeda, at least in the sources I've been able to find,
mm-hmm.
that indicated that, at least for some of these secret societies, the ultimate goal of their physics projects was some sort of portal or gate or ability to travel to extremely distant worlds.
Mm-hmm.
I've, again, never been able to pin down, to my satisfaction, where this effort originated within Germany, or mm. even what became of it. It's just a story that simply is there, and it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
So that, to me, indicates that there's probably some basis in truth to it. But it also, I think, has to be tempered by the physics realities that were in place at the time of the war, that it would have been just simply beyond anyone's technology to pull that off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If the Bell did something like that, if it were able to do something like that, it would have been, I think, an effect that the Nazis really weren't intending to find.
Mm-hmm.
They may have found by accident.
Hmm.
But I should stress something very significant. If they did find effects like that, the physics would have been so inimical and deadly to any biological life that it would have made such teleportation or transportation just a physical impossibility for a biological life form. And in fact, I get into some of the very strange and deadly effects that the bell had when it was in operation in the book. But again, that also implies that there were temporal displacements or time displacements, and they were probably very significant.
So it's kind of a Raiders of the Lost Ark scenario, I guess.
Yes, exactly. So that's a very good analogy.
Yeah.
It's a project that's so black and so dark that, you know, once again, I stress this, that the Nazis went out of their way to keep this project from falling into anybody's hands at the end of the war.
Yeah.
That means Americans, the British, the French, the Russians, whoever.
Yeah.
It was viewed by them in all of the literature that I've been able to see as being their war decisive, war winning weapon.
Mm.
And that's precisely how they viewed it.
Hmm. So, I mean, to me, this brings to mind the United States, you know, again, alleged a project called the Philadelphia Experiment. Have you heard about
this? Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Any connection, you think?
I do think that there is a connection.
Yeah.
I think it's a connection, actually, in some of Einstein's pre-war unified field theory papers.
Mm.
But I think in the case of the Philadelphia experiment as opposed to the Nazi bell, I think that there is a fundamental difference. I don't think that we were looking for what we found, and I don't think we knew what to do with it once we found it. I think the effects of the experiment rather surprised the people that were conducting it. In fact, one American physicist, after the experiment was done, had a nervous breakdown that was so severe that teams of Navy doctors had to kind of nurse him back to health. But in the case of the Nazi bell, I think that the Germans were intentionally looking for what they found. I think they found it, and moreover, I think they knew what to do with it once they did find it. So I think in that respect, the experiments are somewhat different.
Mm, yeah.
But I do think they arise out of the same basic physics conceptions.
Very interesting. You know, do you think that this was a... you know, in what sense, if you want to go into it, of course, but in what sense, you know, was this a deployable weapon? You know, what were the effects, so to speak?
Well, the effects are very interesting. The Germans tested the Bell device on a number of different organic material, animal life, plant life, reptiles, insects, and unfortunately, probably some inmates and victims from concentration camps.
Mm.
When it was first tested, it killed 5 out of the 7 scientists involved. It turned plants into a kind of a black, greasy goo within a matter of hours after it tested, and oftentimes it would do that without the plants putrefying. In other words, they wouldn't even go off in odor, they just fell apart. I think the Germans were able, to some extent, to limit some of these effects later in the project, but ultimately the effects remained. So this is, I think, part of why they were conceiving of it as a weapon. To put it very briefly, the bell is based on a physics that is capable of locally engineering space-time curvature. So once one has said that, one, of course, opens the door to time displacements, to being able to rip the fabric of space and time. And, of course, once we've said that, we've said that we are in the possession of a physics and a basic technology that theoretically is going to make a hydrogen bomb look like a kitchen hatch.
Yeah,
so this is why I think the Nazis classified it with the extreme classification that they did. They knew exactly what they had their hands on. That being said, to answer your other question, I think that this device represented for them a kind of a prototype device to investigate various areas of this physics. I don't think itself was an actual practical weapon. It was more of a test bed for some of their ideas.
Hmm. Oh, okay, I see. Very interesting. You know, one thing I did want to kind of throw out here, I guess, is, you know, considering the again the alleged, you know, thread of cross nation, if I can say it, that funding, you know, there are threads of information leading to that, you know, American corporations and families and
right.
whatnot actually, you know, were funding the buildup of the Nazi empire, as it were.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, it couldn't, in a sense, I mean, if the Nazis were over there developing their from their end, so to speak, but the main product, so to speak, of what they actually achieved over there would easily, you know, have been moved or shifted over to, you know, another area of the world or whatever, considering that, you know, that they themselves might not have been the main backers of the funding, so to speak, of the technologies that they developed.
Well, that's another excellent question, because the peculiar thing about the bell and the technology it represents is it just more or less drops off the face of the earth at the end of the war. No one really knows where it went. There is every indication, strong indication, that this SS general that I mentioned earlier, Hans Kammler, he disappears entirely at the end of the war. Now, you know, how does a four-star SS general simply disappear and not ever be heard from again? And the other thing that disappears along with him and the bell and all of the project documentation is this gigantic six-engine Junkers 390 aircraft, which is an aircraft that is capable of nonstop flight from Germany to Argentina. So there's really two lines or two avenues that are probable that the bell went. It either came to this country and disappeared into some super secret American Black Projects research program, or it disappeared into an independent and continuing Nazi research program inside of Argentina. And before we discount that possibility, I think your listeners should be made aware of the fact that President Perón of Argentina built for the Nazi scientists that had come to his country during the war a huge modern plasma physics laboratory in a remote province of Argentina called Bariloche. And this plasma physics lab is more or less exactly the type of physics that the Germans were tinkering around with the bell, so it would have been a logical place for them to take it. So your question is an excellent one, because it points out that the money trail is a crucial component of where to look.
Sure.
If we pursue the Argentine angle or line, then, of course, the Nazi penetration and connections with various South American drug cartels would be a source of funding to them. And if we pursue the American line, then, of course, it's the American taxpayer, ultimately, that's funding it.
Sure. So, I mean, yeah, there is a whole, you know, can of worms, so to speak, if we go into, you know, that many of the Nazis actually went to South America, could continue their work there, went, you know, somewhat underground, as it were. There's even a thread that many of the Nazis actually went to, you know, Neuschwabenland down in Antarctica and so forth. Anything that you favor of those theories?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because when I wrote the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, I kind of favored the disappearance into America line. But the more I've researched this story since writing the book, the more I'm favoring its disappearance into some post-war independent Nazi project, either in Argentina or other places in South America. I doubt very much that the Germans would have had a base in Antarctica sufficiently large and well equipped enough for them to continue research on that particular project. I'm not discounting the idea at all of some sort of German post-war presence in Antarctica. I don't think it would have been sufficient for that kind of scientific research. But I do favor the idea now, for reasons I'm hoping to get into in the new book, that the bell probably disappeared into South America somewhere.
Interesting. You know, I have to ask you, what of the similarities between the Nazi bell... What? Hello? Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, can you hear me? Seems like we lost the line. Hello? Strange. Hello? I'm right here. Ja, ringer upp igen då. Ja. Ja, lite så va?
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we must have gotten disconnected somehow. All of a sudden I didn't hear you.
Yeah, well, strange. Yeah, we could still hear you for some reason, but yeah. Some sensitive topic, I guess, there.
Well, it's probably our boys at Fort Meade.
Might be. Hello, boys. Thank you for listening in. Yeah.
Hello. Thanks for listening.
Ah, this is great. Yeah.
You know, it's funny, Henrik, because every time I've been on a talk show talking about this subject, I've had very, very strange things like this happen. I was on a talk show about a month ago with a friend of mine here in the United States that on my end of the phone line, I could hear all of these clicks and pops and things going on, so you never know.
Yeah, exactly. You never know. I can never be too sure. I totally agree. Yeah, I mean, let's continue on there. I'm just going to ask you a question and we'll continue from there, okay?
Sure.
Okay, excellent. Yes, I did want to ask you, Joseph, regarding the similarities between the Nazi bell and, of course, the acorn-like craft that was downed in Kecksburg. Tell us about that. Right. What's your take on that?
Well, for those who don't know the story, there was a famous UFO crash and retrieval operation that occurred in a little American town by the name of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, which is just a little bit southeast of Pittsburgh. It's kind of in the hilly area there in Pennsylvania. And this crash occurred on December 9th in 1965. And unlike the Roswell story, this object was seen by several eyewitnesses who got to the scene before the military did, and they described it as being approximately 9 to 12 feet wide and about 15 to 18 feet tall and acorn-shaped, and it gave off a hissing and popping noise. And those dimensions and the shape connect very clearly to the bell. In other words, the bell's dimensions and its shape are very similar to what happened or crashed at Kecksburg. And the other interesting connection is the sound, because one of the names that the Germans gave the bell was Die Bienenstock, which is the beehive. So the bell, you know, the bell has another connection there, even in terms of the sound.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the most important connection, I think, is what happens after the American military arrive at Kecksburg. They place this little town and its environs basically under martial law for a few hours.
Yeah.
They bring in a truck. They put this object under a tarpaulin, and then they haul it to Wright-Patterson Air Base in Dayton, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there, this device is seen by an American construction worker whose company was contacted to deliver approximately 4,000 ceramic bricks to the airbase. And he delivers them to this hangar where he sees this acorn-like object behind some silk screens up on struts and pedestals. And he describes it as being approximately the same dimensions as the Kecksburg Bell. And this is an incident that happens a couple days after the crash at Kecksburg. So it's probably the same object that we're talking about. Now, these ceramic bricks are extremely interesting to me because it's another data point that connects to the Nazi bell. Because the bell was housed, when it was tested underground, was housed in a chamber in this mine in Ludwigsdorf that was lined with ceramic bricks, precisely like this construction worker described. So there is yet another data point that connects the two. So I speculate, both in Reich of the Black Sun and in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, that something like the bell crashed in Pennsylvania. It got away from whoever was testing it. And incidentally, it comes on a track, the Kecksburg object comes on a track from the Arctic Circle up near Hudson's Bay in Canada, which incidentally is one of the areas that post-war literature indicates that the Nazis had established some secret bases. So, you know, there again, we've got yet another odd little connection.
Mm, yeah.
So when we pile it all up, I think that what crashed at Kecksburg probably was some residue or some relative of this Nazi technology, and that's precisely the reason that the American military showed up so quickly, cordoned off the area so quickly, and carted that device out of there. And I've always found it extremely interesting regarding the Kecksburg story that the day after it occurred, the director of NASA, the governor of the state of Pennsylvania, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States are at President Lyndon Johnson's ranch in Texas. And supposedly, they are, according to the public spin that they put on this meeting, they're supposedly talking about the war in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Now, that may be something that the president and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would discuss, but certainly not the governor of Pennsylvania and the chief of NASA. You know, how stupid do they think we are?
Interesting. You know, I have to ask you, you know, regarding some of the witness testimony in regards to the Kecksburg scenario there, claimed, you know, to hear screams, strange screams. Even there is even testimony that states that someone actually saw a hand coming out of the, you know, top of this acorn-shaped, you know, flying, you know, object, whatever. Any thoughts at all on that?
Well, I have not heard those testimonies. Most of the research that I did on the Kecksburg story was based on the research of an American ufologist by the name of Stan Gordon, who's kind of made that story his own.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he may have uncovered some things since the research that I consulted was done. I wouldn't discount those types of things for a very peculiar reason, because the kind of physics that I think we're dealing with the Bell and also with the Philadelphia experiment is a physics that theoretically, and I stress that word, is potentially capable of some sort of molecular disruption. So, you know, there's no telling really what to do with stories like that. I wouldn't discount them just because they sound strange or weird.
Time machine, fast-forwarding evolution, possible?
That's actually another interesting question, and it's one I don't get into in either book. Mm. However, there's an American novelist by the name of James Rollins who's written a book called Black Order, and it's all about the Bell.
Mm.
And in this novel, he speculates that one of the things that the Bell did because of its extreme time dilation effects was that it was capable of manipulating evolutionary and biological processes. So, you know, where he got his information, I don't know. But, you know, it's another line of speculation that's a rather interesting one.
Oh, yeah, indeed. Oh, fascinating. You know, I think that this will be an excellent place to kind of round things up for this segment, and we're going to continue to speak in the subscriber section about Geetha Death Star, of course. But before we do that, I want to, you know, give you an opportunity to tell people again about your website, about your books, and how we can get them, of course.
The website is www.GeethaDeathStar.com. It's kind of a little blog site for me. I post things very occasionally there. I'm not a real faithful blogger, but I do post some comments and some articles that I've read and what I think about them on the site.
Sure.
The books themselves are available directly from the publisher, which is www.AdventuresUnlimitedPress.com. That's all one word, and it's all lowercase. They're $16.95 American dollars each, and there is a discount of 10% on three or more. They are also available at Amazon.com sites in Europe, so you know they can go there and look at them there.
Excellent.
But all five books are $16.95. I do have a new book coming out sometime in the next 2 to 3 months called The Cosmic War Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics, and Ancient Texts, which should be, I think, available around June is when my publisher thought.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah, great indeed, yeah. So, yeah, everyone, check it out, either adventuresunlimitedpress.com or GizaDeathStar.com for Joseph's personal site. And again, for this segment, Joseph, thank you so much for coming on, and we will continue in the next segment, okay?
My pleasure, Henrik. Thank you for having me on.
We are going to continue now with Joseph in the subscriber section. We are going to dive into his fascinating three-part book series on the Giza Death Star. We'll talk about the origins and purpose of the pyramids, especially the Great Pyramid, the builders, the possible usage, deployment, and destruction of this giant machine or device, as it were. Joseph also makes the connection to what is known as the exploding planet hypothesis and ties this together with a war of the gods or the ancients. Very interesting material. So I hope that you join us in the subscriber section for much more. If you'd like to know more on how to sign up, just click on subscribe from our front page, redicecreations.com, and you can read much more about it from there. I also want to mention that the debate and the number of people that's getting active in the Red Ice Creations forum is increasing and heating up, so why not stop by and join in? Look at the top of the forum, there you'll find more info on how to register and join in. We will be back on Thursday with our regular Michael Tesserion speaking about both the Black Sun and the Exploding Planet Hypothesis. So this is material that will dovetail beautifully with today's show and subscriber interview. Thanks to Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls, this is Henrik Palmgren saying thank you so much for tuning in and following along the show. Until next time, take good care.